Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to Jesse Rogers of ESPNChicago.com for having joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Subscribe and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the National Post, Sean Fitzgerald. Sean, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, fellas. How you doing?
We're doing very well. You have escaped from Markham. Do I understand that you're no longer trapped in the city council room?
Physically, yes. Mentally, I think part of me will always end up being in that chambers.
What time did it end up wrapping up? Sometime around 3:30 in the morning or so?
They moved for a vote at 2:55 a.m., and then the principal started scrumming outside at about 3:30, and I rolled into bed about 4:45, and my two-year-old son woke me up about 7 o'clock.
Ah, sounds just...
It's a good day.
The life of a journalist, it sounds glorious in that sense, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, the hierarchy basically goes movie stars, rock stars, royalty, sports reporters. I think that's fairly well established.
Exactly. Sean, can you explain to our listeners how this proposed arena in Markham is scheduled or set to be paid for?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of questions here, and we'll get into that, I'm sure, as we go. But the basic foundation of this is that there's an arena proposal that's going to cost $325 million. It's going to seat 20,000 people. It's going to be in what is now basically farmland, about 36 minutes north of the Air Canada Center in the city of Markham. The plan is that the city of Markham would take out a loan, basically a debenture, but a loan, for $325 million. Markham would pay back half of that total, so that's $162.5 million, over the course of the agreement, and they'd pay that back with a variety of sources. But the primary source is also one of the most contentious, which is a levy that the city of Markham would pay on local developers. So if you're a developer and you're making a block of condo units, $2,000 from each of those condos would go towards this levy to help pay back for the arena. So the other half of the total, the 162.5, would be paid back by a private group that's being led, coincidentally, by one of the largest developers in the region.
Sean,
we got all that? Yeah. Got all that written down?
Yeah. No kidding. There was some concern about possibly who would incur the losses if there were losses?
Yes. So basically, there's this very vocal group of opposition, taxpayers, and they spoke for, and I'm not kidding, hours on whatever night that was. Again, my therapist has told me to block it, but it's not really working. But honestly, fellas, there are about 70 people, and they get 5 to 10 minutes to speak. And, you know, if there was one thing, if I could paraphrase them all, and it's possible, I'm not against the arena. I just don't want the city to be associated with this any way, shape, or form financially. There are questions. One is, why is the city being used as a bank? Well, you know, maybe the city can get a better interest rate to borrow the $325 million, thereby making it cheaper. But what's the city's role in doing that? Why are they doing that for an arena? The other one is what happens if, say, the condo market pops? And I mean, you know, you can read stories about that every day across mm-hmm. Canada about, you know, the heated real estate market closing, whether it's Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, anywhere across Canada. I'm not familiar with Winnipeg's numbers, but I'm sure there's a common thread somewhere. What happens if that pops and development slows and you don't get that $2,000 from the condos? Who's on the hook? Well, then it goes to your property taxes, and taxpayers don't want to pay for an arena that would be, you know, used ostensibly to house an NHL team.
If it appears when this team does come into the NHL that it'll be almost a guaranteed moneymaker, though, Sean, why is there not more of a burden on the owners, prospective owners, to finance this privately?
And that's exactly the question that was asked over and over again. It's, you know, if this is going to be such a financial bonanza, why do we have to pay for even part of this? If this is going to make the private group really rich, and again, you don't have to go far to find somebody who's going to say this is going to be a huge success. Mm-hmm. Why does the city have to be on the hook for that at all? Now, the risk is, of course, is that if you build it, they won't necessarily come. Now, Paul Kelly was the first one, and he was smart. He got his name on first so he could get the heck out of it. But the former head of the NHLPA got up And it sounded like he was threatening the city. He's like, if you let this opportunity pass, you might not get another NHL team. You might not get another shot at an NHL team. And he ended off saying, if you build it, they will come. But all public sentiments, all public statements have actually been to the contrary, that you can build the arena, but you're building it without a guarantee the NHL will come. And if this arena was built and it wasn't filled by an NHL team, and keep in mind, fellas, that there's no anchor tenant on this. They're going to, they claim that they can make money off of this 20,000 seat arena by filling it with like traveling circuses and overflow concerts from the Air Canada Center, wrestling, boxing, Ontario Hockey League team. And that's all, I think, up for speculation on how profitable that project might be. But this is all for an NHL play. And if you don't have a guarantee for an NHL team, then there's inherently some risk.
Worth discussing, Sean. We're joined by Sean Fitzgerald of the National Post. Worth discussing, who are the main proponents behind this project? Rudy Batty, is that, do I have the name correct?
Rudy Batty, yes. He is the head of the Remington Group, and the Remington Group basically owns, and I got to get my geography right on this, it owns all of the land from Toronto to Hudson's Bay, and maybe all the way out to Kenora. I'm not sure. It's massive. Like he owns a lot of land, and he is one of the most influential developers north of the city, and really in southern Ontario. So he is the guarantor. His company is the guarantor of that private group's $162.5 million. And it's their land, and they own all of the land basically around it. So, you know, there are some complex plays involved there. But the driving force, really, the public face of this is Graham Roughston. And he recently stepped down as the chairman of Bauer Performance Sports Limited. And you probably know that company by wearing their gloves or their skates or using their sticks when you go play shinny.
That's Bauer Hockey, right?
Yes.
Sean, how can the NHL, I'm moving to the NHL now, how can the NHL in good faith explore the idea of expansion when they've owned the Phoenix Coyotes for 4 years?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, isn't it? That's sort of, I mean, if we go back to some lockout talk, Phoenix seems to be the hill that Gary Bettman's going to die on.
We know how well that worked during the lockout.
It worked pretty well, right?
Yeah.
I'm in a fog after spending all that time in Markham Council Chambers, so a lot of my memories just shelled. But, I mean, yeah, so you have Phoenix, and you don't have to go very far on Google to find mentions of other teams that are in various degrees of financial distress. But on the other hand, you know, there are examples, and I grant you these are different circumstances each, where arenas are built and teams don't follow. And you also have a waiting list, it would seem, of a couple of markets that might be ahead of Markham, no matter how profitable, in terms of getting a team. And then you also have the issue of the Toronto Maple Leafs are 35 minutes south and might just, you know, raise a hand to say, wait a second, this is our backyard. I don't think we're going to give this up without a fight.
Sean,
there's a whole bunch of issues in play here. Yeah, no, sorry.
No, yeah, you know, Richie and I were talking about this off air. Obviously, but the Markham area is to get an NHL team, it looks like it's most likely going to be an expansion team, but there happens to be a couple NHL teams, you know, in the immediate vicinity. How much are the Toronto Maple Leafs going to seek from a second Toronto area team?
Well, and that's the quadrillion-dollar question. It's, you know, we go back to Phoenix, and we go back to, I think, 2009, when Jim Balsillie tried to buy the Coyotes out of bankruptcy in Phoenix. And one of the issues that Balsillie's team tried to bring up in court, and it was sort of pushed aside, but it's this notion of the Toronto Maple Leafs having a veto power over any other team coming in within, I think it's a 75-mile radius of Toronto. Now, Markham falls, you know, very, very close to that. It's 36 kilometers away from the Air Canada Center. So if that exists, what would that lead to? In legal terms, I'm not smart enough, fellas. I have a liberal arts degree, and I just barely got that. But that suggests to me that you're going to be into some legal finagling. And, you know, if the Toronto Maple Leafs do have a strenuous objection, if they do have something on paper from the league, then that could lead to a legal nuclear winter. I mean, there are just so many questions about, you know, the legalities of that, whether antitrust or you know, Competition Bureau involvement, or, you know, just how much of a payoff, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe they get an ownership stake in the second team. I'm joking. No, I don't. I mean, it's just a huge question that always seems to be looming anytime Kitchener, Hamilton, or now Markham comes into play is what power, what what authority would the Leafs wield in a move like this?
Sean, similar question. You know, Buffalo Sabres aren't far away from Toronto or you know, a second team in Markham. You know, how much would they seek, if anything?
And again, I have to throw that into Google, because I don't know if Markham, I know Hamilton would, I believe Kitchener might, but within that, you know, the degree of, you know, financial exclusivity, the regional exclusivity, whether Markham would fall into the territorial rights for the Sabres, they might just be just outside it.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Sean Fitzgerald of the National Post. We're discussing the Markham Arena project just north of Toronto.
Sean, how likely, I mean, there's also been some talk about a possibility that a prospective second team in Toronto would be a tenant of the ACC. Do you see any way that happens?
It'd be an interesting one. I mean, the ACC is pretty, it's booked pretty solid. I guess it could be done. I don't know how that would work. It's certainly not unprecedented. You look at Madison Square Garden, and they've got, you know, two and three events going on a day sometimes, and certainly the Staples Center in Los Angeles has two basketball teams and a hockey team. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, but it would raise questions about, I think, ownership in that one of Bell or Rogers or Larry Tenenbaum, you would think would probably break off from the ownership group of MLSE to own that second franchise. But, I mean, it certainly is an interesting question. And it's you know, logistically speaking, it's not impossible.
Sean, this goes back to my last question. And you just brought up Bell and Rogers and MLSE. And assuming that this Markham team is owned by someone else, we've heard it, George Gillette, and we've heard there might be others involved. How risky is it for the NHL to not work with Bell and Rogers, who are obviously huge TV partners, in working something out to bring a second team to Ontario, to the Toronto area?
Yeah, I think you could probably cross George Gillette off the list of ownership for Markham. I don't think that's a real thing that's going to happen. If it is an expansion franchise, it's going to cost a bundle of money. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the exact cost is, but I know that, you know, the three of us probably wouldn't be able to swing it with the bank loan and college loans and all that sort of thing. So I'd maybe cross his name off the list. And, you know, with Bell and Rogers, it's interesting because I think the common school of thought is that, you know, they went in 50-50 more or less on the Leafs because they couldn't afford to let the other one take it, but just because the Leafs are so valuable. And I don't know if that would change with a new Markham team. If a Markham team was to come in, or, you know, Hamilton, or, you know, Guelph or Kitchener-Waterloo or wherever this eventual Southern Ontario team lands, the Leafs will still be the Leafs. The Leafs will always still be the Leafs. And I don't know if the value of a new team would be enough to entice either one of those companies to move away from the Leafs.
In a hypothetical situation here, Sean, you know, the second team is coming in and the NHL decides to play hardball with Bell and Rogers about not paying them some sort of fee to move the team in there. And Bell and Rogers says, well, hey, you know, you're playing hardball with us here. Well, we're going to play hardball with you in the next TV negotiations. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, there's a million different possibilities. If there is a piece of paper that says, you know, from the NHL from God knows how long ago, but I mean, during the bankruptcy proceedings in Phoenix, some documents were produced in court that would suggest that MLSE had rights it was willing to zealously protect in terms of its territory. If a document like that does exist, then maybe they do have some legal standing, but then you also have the Canadian Competition Bureau that might come in and say, you know, are these fair practices? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so many questions that the only real answer is a lot of lawyers are going to make a lot of money off of it.
Sean, a couple questions just to wrap this up. You mentioned Paul Kelly early in the interview, and, you know, he had a front row seat to the proceedings in Markham. You know, under whose auspices was he there? Was he hired by the potential ownership group in order to represent them at the council meeting?
That's the million-dollar question again. There's a lot of million-dollar questions. I just hint at how much money is going to be dripping out of this deal if anything ever does come of it. He was there apparently on his own volition? And you notice the inflection of my voice there? It's sort of a question mark?
Yeah.
He said he was there, that he had paid his own money, he had taken time off of work by himself on his own to come up and speak. In the very next breath, He did say that he has done consulting work with Graham Roston before and that the two did have ties. So I'm going to leave the dot, dot, dot there, and I guess we can all connect them. He said he wasn't being paid by Graham Roston, but it was obviously pretty clear who he was there for. And certainly by the tenor of his remarks, that it was pretty clear which side of the fence that he was standing on.
Last question, then, Sean, we'll let you go on this one. You know, it does seem like it might end up being a foregone conclusion that there's a second hockey team in the Toronto area. It just seems there's too much money and too much of a good reason for there not to be. What do you see the timeline of that being?
Well, I think they're two separate issues. The arena in Markham is going to face, it passed the vote. It survived the vote. It survived sort of the palace coup. But it's still got a long way to go to ever getting a shovel in the ground. They don't have a site plan approved. They don't have a memorandum of understanding with the city about the terms. They don't have a lease signed. So this isn't going to be the last time that, you know, we're all standing around waiting for a very important vote from Markham City Council. So that's one thing. The eventuality of a second team in Southern Ontario, I do think that it will happen. I mean, you just have to look at other regions. That, you know, two teams in Southern California, you have all of those teams now in New York, and, you know, getting even closer together with Brooklyn and the Rangers and the Devils. So in that respect, it is inarguably an underserved market. And yes, I do think that there is a lot of reason to think it'd be profitable. And, you know, you look at the NHL and the NHLPA now tied together with hockey-related revenue, I think there will be a lot of pressure and a big push to get it. When, though, I don't know, because you have Quebec City, you have Seattle, and you have a whole bunch of other markets that, you know, the league would have, you know, are interested in hosting an NHL franchise.
Sean, as a city, as you know, Winnipeg is a city full of people that once, more than once, had to spend their evenings watching Glendale, Arizona City Council meetings. So we can certainly sympathize with you in spending your night in the Markham City Council. Hopefully you don't have to do it too many times, but thanks again for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks for having me, fellas. Have a good weekend.
Take care, Sean. Thanks a lot, Sean. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290.
We're going to talk about tonight's game and tomorrow night's game. Okay. I'd like to see the question about tonight's game and tomorrow night's game. Sorry.
Not what PK brings back in the lineup. Not at all.
He's not in the room yet, so let's talk about that when he's going to be in the room.
That was Andre Markov responding to questions from journalists about PK Subban after the Montreal Canadiens re-signed him to a two-year deal earlier this week. He's made his debut on the season for the Habs right now in a game against Buffalo. You know, when a player re-signs with a team, usually most of his teammates will make some sort of generic comments about how it's good to have him back and, you know, we're glad to see him and, you know, what a great player, what a great addition to the team. I've never heard such apathy and disdain for a teammate coming from as I heard from the Montreal Canadiens, from PK Subban's teammates upon that re-signing.
Well, you know, we saw the contract earlier this week. It was a bridge contract. He was signed to 2 years. And, you know, we know that PK Subban has fought his teammates in during practice. And he's had dust-ups, you know, not just physical dust-ups, but, you know, he's a controversial figure. I love PK Subban's game. I think his future is bright, and I think, you know, Andre Markov is back now, and last year PK Subban took a huge step forward in his development as a defenseman. He got better defensively, and he's also got obviously offensive talent, but he played big time minutes. But I think within that dressing room, Richie, you know, the people look at PK Subban, there might be some jealousy there.
If you're not liked in the dressing room, I think you're the problem if that many players apparently don't like you. And again, we're speculating here, but...
Well, we're speculating somewhat educatedly based on the... The players know... What's that?
Educatedly?
Probably not.
Okay.
The players know they're going to be asked about PK Subban re-signing with the Habs. All they have to do is give a generic comment, you know, and if anyone knows anything about generic comments, it's NHL players.
Yeah.
So... For them to not even do that really speaks, I think, a lot to how he's viewed within the dressing room.
Oh, I think I think that was one of the negotiating ploys of Marc Bergevin. He says, "Well, first of all, you haven't proven to us that you're worth that much money." He also, I think, basically kind of dared him and said, "Prove it to us that you're a guy in the room that everybody wants to be around." prove to us that you've changed or you're going to change. I think that was a negotiating ploy, and that was part of the prove it. Prove it in terms of points. Prove it also that we want you here and that they want you here. And if you're not liked in the room by apparently that many people, then you have issues. And now he's a showboater. He sometimes doesn't play defense. Sometimes he carries the puck too far. He does certain things that can come with maturity. The question is, what's the interaction like with his teammates? And clearly, they weren't desperate to have him back. And, I mean, him and Markov are just on the ice there for a goal by Rene Bork. So, I mean, that's a good sign. But reading between the lines, and then, I mean, I'm sure you're next going to bring up, Drew, the fact that the low five has been banned.
Well, it's a bizarre situation where the coach has dictated to both PK Subban and Carey Price that after a Habs win, their celebration was to do three low fives in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Therrien said, no more of that.
Yep.
We're going to have respect for ourselves. We're going to have respect for our opponents. And we're in this as a team. So the only celebration after a win now is going to be similar to what we see with the Winnipeg Jets. You know, everyone goes to center, raises their sticks, and salutes the crowd. No more of this PK and mm-hmm. Carey show, less so Carey. But no more of the PK Subban show. You are now just a cog in the machine. You are not off, you know, alone on your side.
I don't have an issue with it. I think, you know, you have this liberal trend in sports. Well, everybody, let them do what they want. Let them celebrate. Let them do what they want. I don't mind it. You're trying to build a team here. You're trying to get players to at least exhibit to the fans that they're all in it together. And I'm not saying, oh, you know, they can't have that creativity and things. But if they deem that to be an issue, and you have to understand something, you know, it's easy for us to say it from fairly far away in terms of what that's done. You don't know if those celebrations have come as a result of maybe players hanging out only the two of them in the locker room or doing certain things. So you're trying to really build a culture there. And I have no issue with that. You know, the low fives are fine. And this is another point. The low fives are fine if you're first in the conference.
Right. A lot was made out of these low fives. It's not just about PK Subban. Michelle Therrien is a new coach. Well, you know, he's coached with Montreal before, but you know, this is he's trying to get Richie touched on what it's about here. Culture. It's about the whole team. This he knows PK Subban's coming back. Obviously this got a lot of attention in Montreal. But this is a good opportunity for him to say, "Okay, PK, you're coming back. I'm the coach here, and you know, we missed the playoffs last year. And it's about business this year. We got to get back into the playoffs here. And I agree with Richie. No problem with it. I mean, you still want the guys to celebrate, have a good time on the ice when they can. But you also, it's not professional wrestling either.
No, and I think you're seeing a culture shift amongst the Montreal Canadiens. Marc Bergevin is coming mm-hmm. in. And the sort of ironic thing is Marc Bergevin is known as being a more of a jovial guy. But he also knew when business came first. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of what they might be trying to instill in PK Subban yep. is a business-first mentality. All the sideshow stuff, the PK Subban-first stuff, mm-hmm. is to be done in the time and the place, and it's not on a daily basis.
I want to say something here. I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, okay? Because, first off, I love professional wrestling, as you know. But
good to know.
This is the thing here. And this is why, you know, I agree when Don Cherry, you know, gives guys praise when they score a goal and then they skate to the bench and they don't make too big of a deal about it.
Act like you've been there before.
There's no problem with having a good time on the ice and celebrating. But why is it a big deal when Nail Yakupov, you know, slides across the ice and after he scores a goal and gets his first NHL goal? Well, the big deal about it is because everyone talks about it and it's not all positive. And you don't want everyone talking about this and, you know, the high fives and all this. You know what? If you're a good hockey player, you should be known for being a good hockey player, mm-hmm. not because you have a good time on the ice with your teammates and all that. That's sure, that adds to your personality. But at the end of the game, your job is to be a solid hockey player, to play your role the best of your ability. And he just wants to take that. He doesn't want there to be a sideshow to the season.
For some teams, it works. And for some teams, you know, if this team starts building and they become better and they build together and they work together, and they may be more liberal with things like that. But it's a new coach. In that room, it's a new coach, and he's trying to put a stamp on the team, and they're a harder team to play against. He's more aggressive. He's got a temper, and I think a lot of those things, well, first of all of those things Marc Bergevin knew. And when he hired Michelle Therrien, he said, you know, I know he's dealt with the media here before. I know he's a fiery guy who's learned to control his temper a little bit more, but he still has the temper, and he knows that he's going to use it a bit. And, you know, I think that it's a complete and total contrast. It's like, you know, you date one girl and then you go to the complete opposite. And this is the same thing. Jacques Martin wouldn't say three words. No. He was calm, quiet, and you've gone to the opposite. And lots of times they do that in sports, as people do in life.
And, you know, P.K. Subban's on the ice right now against Buffalo. And, again, I think he is a great star of the new NHL. And I think that, you know, him doing the media during the lockout and all that, and he does a lot of good things for charity. But, you know, do that stuff off the ice. Be that person off the ice. And so the low five stuff, I know it's been blown out of proportion a little bit, but it's really not just about the low fives. It's about how you conduct yourself on a daily basis in the NHL.
And I think what his teammates said to him, you know, not directly, but what his teammates said by their lack of comment this week is, prove it to us, come into this dressing room, and we don't want to hear from you until you've proven that you can be a vocal leader.
Sure helps that they were winning when he was out of there.
Oh, absolutely. Sure helps. It makes Mark Bergevin's life a lot easier in signing that contract. The fact that the Habs are, you know, 4-2 through the first six games without P.K. Subban in the lineup, and really, given the record and the skill set that the Habs have on the ice, I think good things in store for Montreal this year. Let's leave it there. When we come back, we're going to deal with the article in today's Winnipeg Free Press by our friend Randy Turner about, you know, I don't even know how. Elite hockey programs is the nicest way I can put it. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus joins us behind the proverbial glass to get us on and off the air like the expert that he is. This segment of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is brought to you by Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue. Pizza baked, well done. If you're looking for a place to watch tomorrow's Super Bowl, Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza is your place to be. They have their coal-fired ribs on special tomorrow. They have some domestic beer specials, and they have an over-under special. If the total points scored between both teams totals less than 34 points, all appetizers are 50% off. So if you're looking for a place to watch the game tomorrow, the Ravens and the 49ers, Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza is your place to be.
Who's going
to
win that game tomorrow, Drew?
I know what Richie's going to say because he's a big Niners fan. I do think the Niners are going to win, and I don't think it's going to be as close as the line says. I think the Niners win by double digits.
Whoa.
Well, Drew, I'm a Niners fan. That's pretty confident.
It's as bold as the mustard that you put on your corned beef.
I think the difference is going to be the Niners running the ball in Baltimore, but I'm not sure it'll be by more than 6 or 7 points if they win.
I love Kaepernick. I love the Ravens, you know, big bad Ravens and all that, but I can't go against the Niners. The Niners, I think, are too talented offensively, and from what I've told, pretty damn good defensively, too.
24-17 final.
24-17. Now, over under, is he eating 24 slices of pizza tomorrow?
Oh, way over.
Okay. Well, the best, I was telling Richie, we go to his house every year for the Super Bowl. It's easily the best food day of the year. My calorie intake is even higher than it usually is, so
it's just pretty high.
Not a good day to check the old BMI, Drew.
The only thing higher than your BMI is alcohol, your BAC.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. Oh, man.
Both not good.
Yeah, both not good, indeed. Very interesting article in today's Winnipeg Free Press by our friend Randy Turner, talking about, you know, elite hockey programs in Canada, and really it just boils down to the cost of playing Canada's national game at this point in time. You know, when we were growing up, there were some elite, you know, I believe that if you were a good player, you know, at least, you know, you went and you played for the Rangers.
Sure.
I believe that was it. And then if
Double
you were really
A,
good,
yep.
then you, I think it was the Monarchs after the
Triple
Rangers.
A, yeah.
I assure you, I never got anywhere near those levels. But, you know, but hockey when we were growing up, it wasn't 12 months a year. You might take a 1 week or a 2 week, you know, course in the summer, you know, sort of, you know, a day camp sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as intensive as it is now. Mm-hmm. You know, is it a positive that it's this intensive at this point in time? And are parents going overboard with these elite hockey programs that are recruiting kids from across the country to play on these superstar teams?
Yeah, it's overboard. And Wayne Gretzky, greatest hockey player of all time, said the kids should be playing different sports in the summer. Play baseball, play different things like he did.
Yeah, I mean, Wayne Gretzky was a baseball player in the summer growing up in Brantford.
Worked out for Trevor Gretzky.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that, you know, you try different things. You let your kids dabble. They play basketball, they play soccer. I mean, I think that one of the big problems, there's so many problems. One of the big ones is when parents hitch their wagons to their children, hoping that their children are going to make it big, and then they make it big. And you hope that's not the case, but it is a factual reality of a part of hockey in Canada now, with the money that is at the end, you know, that pot of gold. And you see that, but you also see the costs are exorbitant. To play hockey these days, every kid needs a one-piece stick because I don't know why. I mean, some of them, I don't know how a stick can cost that much money for some of the kids who are just learning how to play hockey. Even if they don't learn how to play hockey, the cost of the sticks. Then never mind the ice time, and then the extra ice time one add on, and then the summer. I mean, and what you have is, you know, Ezzy and I, we mentioned before, we've coached a couple times, and the area where we coached was essentially had one team. And when we used to play, that area had four teams at the same level.
Yep.
And what does that mean? And you talk to different coaches about it, less kids are playing hockey. Why? One of the biggest reasons, the first reason you always hear is money.
I'd agree with that, yeah.
And what happens is, you know, either there's a gap, an income gap, that is causing the people with more money to be able to have a better advantage, or people with not as much money are deciding they're going to invest it all in the child and hope that it pays off. But then the pressure is so great on the child that either he does, you know, generally speaking, he won't make it big. You know how hard it is to make the NHL? You know how hard it is to even get into the juniors or into the college? And never mind like Junior B and you know, Division III in the NCAA, and then get something from that. And sure, you can get the education, and that'd be great. But if you're going to the dub, you're really not getting the education, although they have education plans that doesn't always follow through, you know, depending on age and such. So there's so many aspects to this. And it's become so specialized that I think at the end of the day, guys, you want sports to be fun for kids. But when it becomes so specialized and competitive, it isn't. And so where do you draw the line? And then what happens is, you know, to specialize at 15, become specialized at 14, become specialized at 13, become specialized at 12. I mean, let's get a grip here.
You know, you mentioned all of the different aspects to the story, and, you know, for all hockey fans out there, you got to check out Randy Turner's article. It's a great five-page spread in today's Free Press.
We just tweeted it out on our Twitter feed, @IllegalCurve.
And you got to go check it out. And, you know, Richie, you mentioned the cost. You mentioned, you know, how hard it is to get to the pro level. But for me, the last thing that you touched on was the age. And you know, Randy focuses on a lot of an 8-year-old kid who travels around and how much it costs, and that's the thing. You do have to get a grip here. You know, we live in a really competitive world in general, and hockey is very competitive, and you want your kids to get an advantage because, as Randy mentions in the article, WHL teams are gonna scout you at 12 or 13 years old, and then they're going to ask you to come play for them when you're 14, 15 years old. And so if you're 8 or 9, that's when you have to start getting an edge over kids. But you know, an 8 or 9 year old kid who's playing hockey for 12 months a year, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, you have overkill in that situation. Mm-hmm. Is the kid really getting that much better by going in a spring tournament in Pittsburgh or War Road, Minnesota? Maybe you can make that argument, but you could probably make an argument that for a lot of those kids, it's not making that big of an impact.
Let me ask you guys this. When you played youth hockey, mm-hmm. you know, and you played in tournaments, you know, did you ever travel for those tournaments? Did you ever go outside of Winnipeg?
You did once in a while, but not all the time.
No. Where was the furthest you'd go in your entire minor hockey career? Maybe Brandon?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, 2 hours away, something like that.
And that's you were probably considered a pretty good player if you were going that far. Yeah. I mean, you know, these are for-profit,
yep.
you know, organizations and leagues, and call them whatever you want. They're for-profit. The problem is there's no overseeing body. And, you know, in this article, I believe Peter Woods from Hockey Manitoba yep. is quoted in it. And he talks about how, you know, when it's sanctioned by Hockey Manitoba, you know there's at least some basic principles being adhered to. You know, and it's not all about the bottom line, and there's, you know, certain rules and regulations that have to be followed because they're followed across the country. These tournaments are really running on their own rules, their own operations, and they don't have anything besides the bottom line in mind.
It's a financial aspect, Drew. People have coached people I deal with, you know, on a day-to-day basis. The cost of financing hockey at any level, because
Well, I mean, you know, in this article, they talk about parents who spend upwards of $20,000 a year on their kids' hockey careers, quote unquote. These kids are 11 years old. Who knows if they have a hockey career? But I mean, these numbers are unfathomable for most people.
And if you're a hockey parent, Richie, and you've got an 11-year-old, and he's a good player for his age group, good player at his community center level, or, you know, and he's going to play AA, and you think, okay, you know what, he's a very good AA player at 12 years old. If you want to spend $20,000 and a lot of money on his development, and you think that it's going to set him up for the coming years, and that's going to help him possibly get drafted by a WHL team. If you're in Winnipeg, maybe Brandon notices him, maybe Swift Current, you know, maybe an SJHL team. Okay, that's fine. But if you look at the percentage of guys that will end up and going to play pro, all of us know, you know, there's guys from Winnipeg and, you know, there's a lot of good hockey players out there, but the return on investment has been proven not to be worth it.
How many guys, let me ask you this, how many guys from Winnipeg are there in the NHL?
I'd say there's probably 20 to 30.
I don't think it's that many.
From Winnipeg or Manitoba?
Winnipeg. Well, Manitoba, too.
Say so Manitoba.
Start with Dale Weiss and then make your way to Colton Orr.
I mean, 20 at the most, I would suggest.
I would say it's around 20.
This article quotes this 9-year-old is being flown out to Vancouver. 9-year-old is being flown out to Vancouver to play in some sort of elite tournament.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The words 9-year-old and elite?
Never mind the fact that...
Almost are counterintuitive to one another.
Yeah.
When you also have the fact that nine, let's point this out too, it's before hitting, right? So it could happen you could spend all this money on this kid, and then he ends up being short, and the contact comes, and he doesn't want any part of it, and he never makes it past 13 or 14. I mean, there's so many variables at play. The problem, Drew, is this. It's that when one parent and kids do it, then another parent and kids do it because they feel like they have to keep up. And then what happens is you have a small percentage who are all doing it, and the rest of them just say, hell with this.
That's right. I mean, I think a big problem is it's never the kids. There's never kids demanding to play hockey 12 months a year.
Oh, when you're 9 years old and I mean, you're not writing a check for 10 grand.
Well, I'm not saying that, but, you know, at some point in time, you know, if you're the 9-year-old kid and your parents have invested, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in you to play hockey this year, and it's the middle of August and you say to your mom or your dad, you know, I'd like to go play soccer. You think that parent's going to readily say yes? Unfortunately, a lot of these parents, I think, are living vicariously through their 9-year-olds and, you know, probably turning these kids off of hockey going further and going forward in life, and they get burnt out. Like you said at the start of the segment, Gretzky didn't play hockey 12 months a year, and if it's good enough for Gretzky, it's probably good enough for your kid. Let's go to break. When we come back, I want to continue on this topic. You mentioned something about the future of hockey, of how this will affect the future of hockey in Canada. Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A lot of response on our Twitter feed, at Illegal Curve, regarding the costs of minor hockey and these sort of for-profit hockey leagues, spring hockey tournaments that have sprung up throughout really North America, Canada, and the United States. Good comment from at K_D_Thor, who makes a point, you know, to paraphrase it, that, you know, when you play the same sport year-round, you're putting a lot of stress on the same muscles and the same joints. You know, playing different sports gives, you know, you work different muscles at that point in time to prevent any sort of damage that could be done by overuse. I think that's a fair point.
Also in coaching,
And for those, you know, some people are asking if we have any kids in minor hockey or anything along those lines, and we don't. We're not at that point in our lives.
It
doesn't matter. But we've all been around minor hockey enough. You guys have all coached enough, and we all know the costs associated with everything. We've played enough hockey to know how the world works right now, so we're not completely uneducated on this topic.
Yeah, I've helped pick teams a few years for, you know, picking squads on a couple years in a row for a couple of levels. But it's, another thing is, you know, in my experience, in terms of coaching, I mean, the kids who play all the time, based on the kids who play three other sports, actually, there's no difference in skill. Sometimes the kids who play, you know, a couple of years ago, he played volleyball, he played this, he played that. He was probably the best sense of the game on the team. And the years before that as well. So, I mean, I don't think there's any correlation necessarily at all times. I think sometimes you become too obsessed with it, and you do too many, you know, you're doing too many specific exercises, and then sometimes you lack that team aspect. In any event, I think it's not just Drew hockey. I mean,
oh yeah,
the competitiveness level of everything, the specialization of everything is not letting people, and is causing
You know what this reminds me of? You read about, I mean, I'm not a big basketball guy, but you hear about all these, you know, prep stars in basketball. Yeah. Before they reach the age of 18, they play something called AAU basketball. Mm-hmm. And they travel around the entire United States. And, I mean, a lot of these, you know, high schools that, you know, the LeBron Jameses and the best basketball players play for, you know, are travel teams that, you know, jet off from, you know, if they're based in New Jersey, one weekend right. They're playing a tournament, you know, in Florida, the next weekend they're playing a tournament in California. They're really just, you know, mercenary traveling high school teams. Right. And that's what this sort of concept is in hockey. It's a similar idea.
Drew, if you'll allow me here to read a quote, I think this quote is extremely important.
Please.
For the purposes of this article, Randy Turner interviewed Zinger, assistant general manager of the Winnipeg Jets. He's got three kids that have gone through the minor hockey system. In fact, Jake Heisinger, his son, is currently playing for the Winnipeg Blues of the MJHL. And I think this quote by Zinger, is very important. This is what he says in the article. I'm reading it directly. I don't discount hard work or practice at all, but there's a lot of people that will tell you you're predetermined to be a player when you come out of the womb. Talent is God-given. Travis Zajac was going to make it. Summer hockey or not. So is Jonathan Taves. Come on. That's coming from the assistant general manager of the Jets, okay? You might not believe it if I say it or Richie says it. We don't have kids. But that's from Zinger himself.
And I believe he's right. You know, with all due respect, I could have been the hardest working hockey player in the world. I could have spent every minute of my spare time on the ice. I was never going to accomplish anything in the game of hockey.
And again, we're not criticizing parents who are making the decision to put their kids in spring hockey. That is completely your decision. I'm not going to tell you what you should or should not do with your kid or your money. And for some people, that's going to pay off, in dividends further down the road. Maybe that's going to turn into, like we said, a junior hockey career. But we all also have to mention this because, you know, we have a responsibility. We have a voice here on the station. What we're saying is, you know, you might want to reconsider what you think that's going to do for your kid.
There's no guarantee. I mean, if you're planning on living off your kid's winnings or earnings as an NHL player, you're probably fooling yourself a little bit.
Yeah, you have to hope that's limited in terms of the purpose. And again, and as he made it, spoke well there in terms of, you know, enrolling your kids, I think everybody here in this room sees a value in having kids playing hockey.
Yep.
100% do. And that's why we're involved in the game. We love the game. But I think it's just over-enrollment and things like that that takes it a step too far as many of us are concerned. So I don't want people to take it as if we're not supportive of the purpose of playing hockey. But you also have to give, first of all, I mean, the children need to have a voice in this as well. And you mentioned that earlier, Drew, and I think that's important. And they also have to know that it's kind of their decision. And so we're not going to be able to tell parents how to do their job. They can do what they want to do. But, you know, it's fun to be able to be involved in other sports and to not burn out. And you read a lot of cases these days about burnout.
Sure.
And kids turn away. And actually an interesting one, Roy McGregor has almost finished his book. It's called Wayne Gretzky's Ghost. It's a compilation of articles he's written over the years. What happened with Alexander Digg is he kind of burned out. He said, you know what, I don't want this. This is not what I want. This is not, the passion wasn't there. So, and you see it sometimes in other leagues as well, you know, in other sports too, is the player hasn't really had a choice and the love for the game isn't there. It wasn't developed. So, I mean, it goes both ways. You can have a love for the game and play all the time and love it and want to be a part of it, but it also goes the other way. So parents need to be cognizant of the fact that it's not always one way and you have to be able to read the child and let the child make decisions. And a child at 9, his preference for the game may vary when he reaches 13 and whatever his friend's doing, what's he doing? And you know, and if by traveling all the time and doing these different things, is he missing out on an opportunity to meet friends if he were to stay and do this and play the sports with the different sports with those same people he grew up with? There's all factors to take into account here.
You mentioned earlier off air about the impact you thought this was going to have on hockey in Canada long term, I guess more so on the international level.
I have concerns about it because what I think happens is you see, you know, what are we reading? We're listening, or there's features about Connor McDavid, who is, I think he turned 9 last week. I'm kidding.
He's actually 15, Six, yeah. 15
I'm
years
almost
old.
16, I'm, yeah. I'm kidding, but yeah. How many more features can I see on a 15-year-old kid on TV?
Or Sean Day.
I just don't care, and it's enough already. And I think the point is, Drew, as you get to a specialized, you get to a level where there's certain kids are just so good, and then a bunch of other parents will enroll their kids to be just as good, and the other parents who can't afford it or don't want to do whatever it may be, what happens is if there's such a gap in talent and obsessive control over skill and such, there's such a gap, then the play tapers off, the cost is an issue, and parents and kids play different sports because different sports are available to them at less cost. Basketball, soccer, all those are cheaper. So what I think will happen if this stays on this same trajectory is you'll have the international level will be fine because those specialized kids will always show up.
The elite of the elite.
But the big numbers will continue on a downward spiral. And that'll eventually catch up to you.
And registration in hockey is dropping, and I believe has dropped year after year in this country as of late. Soccer is certainly much more registered for than hockey is. Largely, you would associate that to the cost. But you're right. If you're an average player, the average guy who just likes to go play, or the average kid who wants to go play, is oftentimes being squeezed out because of the pressure on him to move from average to elite when, you know, such a small percentage of the population is truly elite at anything.
Well, I think that's a good point. And I know that, you know, Richie mentioned it last segment about the different aspects here. There's the reality that your kid is going to play pro hockey or NHL, 0.001%. I think there was an academic study done about it. But the cost can't be, you know, overlooked at all. I mean, I think we're somewhere around 500,000 kids playing hockey, and that, let's say it goes down, even though I don't have the numbers in front of me, let's say it goes down 10 or 15,000 per year. You're still going to have hundreds of thousands of kids around Canada playing hockey. We're always going to be an elite hockey country, even though Russia, U.S., Finland, Sweden, they're all, you know, they've all caught up over the years. You know, obviously the U.S. winning the World Junior Tournament this past year. The issue is that maybe we have to just be happy with that right there, that hockey, and accept realities here. Hockey's an expensive sport. The equipment's gotten out of control. To compete Crazy. To compete with, you know, the kid down the street from you or the kid in the town near you, to send him to that elite spring hockey tournament to pay $8,000, a lot of people are just going to look at that and say, what, I work hard for my money. I make $60,000 a year. I'm not going to spend $15,000 or $20,000 for my kid, the off chance he might get a college scholarship, he might, you know, maybe one day make, you know, people are going to look at that, parents are going to look at that and say, no, I'm not interested in that. My kid can play community center hockey and that's good enough. He'll have fun, but I don't think he's going to ever amount to a pro hockey player.
What's the average salary in Canada? Is average income in somewhere in 43 range, I think, around there?
Sounds familiar, sure.
So you look at the after tax dollars and obviously paying expenses of living and such, it's a thin line between affording, a $200 stick. What if your kid breaks that $200 stick?
Well, and it's not like they don't break very easily, those $200 sticks.
Even a 70, I mean, the cost of sticks have gone up far, far higher than the inflation over the past 10 years.
Oh, of course. I mean, and it's interesting, Remus emailed us this article from our friend James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail, it's an article about how Bauer hockey equipment is taking on the problem of sagging minor hockey enrollment in Canada. Since 2009, 2010, when it peaked at 440,000 registrations between the Tyke and Midget age groups, it's dropped down 13,000 registrations to 427,000 in 2011-2012. So no wonder Bauer Hockey Equipment is trying to do something about that. Their bottom line is affected when the one less player isn't playing hockey.
Yes, sir.
They're after the bottom line, but as far as 440,000 versus 427,000 or 380,000, whatever it is, I mean, that's still a lot of kids playing hockey, and it's very high relative to the other good international countries. I don't think we're going to need a summit, and there's going to be any issues. Canada's always going to have. We're all at the Olympics, at the World Juniors. We're always going to be one of the favorites. The issue here is that are we dealing with these realities and just saying that hockey's expensive, and you're going to potentially lose some people participating because they're going to look at other sports, soccer, mixed martial arts, whatever, you know, enrollment is going up in, and they're going to pass.
Absolutely right. Let's leave it there. When we come back, NHL news and notes. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. For a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, the Incredible Boris. One final night 7:45 p.m. show is already sold out. We'll get to Ezzy in a minute. The 10:30 show has some tickets remaining, so you can give Rumors a call at 204-488-4520 to see the incredible Boris. Worth also noting, Rob Schneider, at the end of this month, all the shows, even the additional shows that have been added, completely sold out.
We got our tickets, though.
We got our tickets.
We have connects.
We have connections. Big thank you to Winnipeg, of course.
Sheldon.
For making Rob Schneider a complete and total success. Those tickets all sold out, but you should go see the Incredible Boris. 10:30 show tonight, still available. Ezzy, you saw the Incredible Boris on Wednesday.
Yeah, the Incredible Ezzy saw the Incredible Boris. That's actually the second time, maybe even third time that I've seen him. Got to give a shout out to Boris. If you ever have a chance to see this guy, he's great. He hypnotizes people. I believe he's actually appeared on Maury Povich. But my favorite part about the performance is actually afterwards. As everyone knows, Drew used to work at Rumors, used to be the manager there, did an admirable job as well. But I was talking to him, and I actually was trying to arrange him to come into the show and hypnotize you into doing a good job.
Nice.
And he said, you know what? I love Drew. You know, he congratulates you on your marriage, by the way.
Yeah.
But he just said, no, I can do a lot. I've been all over the world, and I've hypnotized people into, you know, many things. But, you know, I can't help out Drew on the radio show.
Let's be honest. If the lockout was still going on, we probably would have had an hour of hypnosis on this radio station today.
NHL News and Notes.
NHL News and Notes for this Saturday afternoon. We start in Ottawa. Jason Spezza out indefinitely. He's got a herniated disc in his back. Sounds like a minimum of 2 months that Jason Spezza will be out of the lineup for the Senators. You know, how obviously, I mean, it's sort of a silly question, but how impactful is this injury, and how can the Senators try and fill his void to some degree?
Almost impossible, Drew. You mean he can't fill the void of one of the top five passers in the National Hockey League, in my opinion. You know, he leaves a huge hole there. Mihalik and him obviously had some nice chemistry, and, you know, they had moved Alfredson to the second line. They're going to need some more offense from their defense, and they're going to need to kind of win 2-1 games. It's going to be tough with the system that they employ, especially with the cost on the power play that Spezza will have. I really like what Paul McLean is doing there. This injury may be insurmountable, especially in this shortened season where 2 months is essentially the whole thing.
Yeah, when I saw this, first, I thought maybe it would be 3 or 4 weeks. Remember, he's had back problems for, it seems, almost like 5 years now. And what it looks like Ottawa's going to do now, obviously Kyle Turris now becomes their number one center. Mika Zibanejad, who's played 3 games, he's going to get more ice time, obviously. Maybe they'll call up, remember they acquired Stefan DaCosta, who was playing in Binghamton. I mean, this is devastating, Drew. I mean, Jason Spezza, after having a couple of down years and facing all of that criticism and whether or not he was going to be traded last year, proved why he was an elite player, you know, the first couple of years after the lockout. This is absolutely devastating. You can't replace a guy, and that right off the bat, let's say it. Nobody, Kyle Turris isn't going to replace that offense. Kyle Turris is doing a good job, but now it's a total question, and I don't know the answer to this, whether those guys, like I mentioned, Mika Zibanejad, who's got limited NHL experience, he's only 19 years old, or maybe he's 20, but he's 19 or 20, and I don't know if they can do it. Ottawa is already, Jared Cowan's already out for the year. Mm-hmm. They've already had to call up Peter Wierkoch to replace him. It's a very, very tough injury for them. Terrible timing, and hopefully if Ottawa's, you know, able to stay in the playoff race, then he can come back, you know, in early April, mid April. But this is bad.
That was what I was going to ask. Will this prevent them from making the playoffs?
Likely, I'd say probably 80% now. I think also, you know, as he talks about Turris, well, what happens now with Turris, who's been excelling at the second center spot, is that he plays against the best competition now. So he goes from, well, likely they're going to match up against Turris and Albertson in that line with their best defensemen. So when you're going up and playing Boston, Spezza's getting a steady diet of Chara and opens up Turris. Well, no longer the case. Now Turris in that line likely will get a steady diet of Chara. And, you know, and so that's the problem that you face with an injury like this. It hurts you at all levels.
Greg Jamieson failed in his bid to acquire the Phoenix Coyotes.
Hold on. Remus, did we not have a moratorium on the Coyotes talk?
I think we banned it, yeah.
Sorry. Drew, you've got to put $5 in the jar.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have no jar. We actually, I have to go spend $5 to buy a jar to put it in there. Yeah,
and then put $5 in it.
I'll be quick with it. How about that? Where does this team end up? Where do we go from here with this?
time is running out.
You know, I don't even know. Again, we've been speechless on this. You know, on H&L earlier this week, Gary Laws was saying that he thinks Seattle is probably the best destination for the Phoenix Coyotes before Quebec or Markham. Well, we know Markham's far away.
God.
You know what? I have absolutely no idea. It looks like other investors might come in here, but I think this is pretty clear that Greg Jameson apparently went to China. I read that he was trying to get investors from China. I mean, I think it's pretty clear he's not going to be the owner of this team.
You know, it's interesting because when I see the Phoenix Coyotes and the troubles that they're facing, when I watch the first two periods of the Florida-Winnipeg game on Thursday, all I think to myself is, you know what this league needs more of? Expansion.
Why is Remus playing the snoring?
I don't know. He's tired of this topic, I guess, But back to that point, you look at Florida and Winnipeg, there were 2,000 people at the game, maybe 3 maximum.
Yep.
And then you look at the quality of play in the first two periods, and I actually fell asleep during the second period. That's how bad. I'm not joking. I fell asleep during the second period. That's how bad it was. The quality of the hockey was brutal. And then you look at Phoenix. They've owned the team for 4 years. And they're talking about expansion? What a joke.
They need to be sold.
4 years.
Moving on to Vancouver, where Eddie Lack is out for the next 6 months after undergoing hip surgery.
Yeah, that's not good.
With Eddie Lack now being out, and he was probably the guy most people had identified as going to be the backup if and when Roberto Luongo gets traded, do the Canucks now stop shopping Roberto Luongo?
No.
I don't think they stop, Richie. It affects it somewhat, not knowing. I don't even know if Eddie Lack is ready for the NHL. He played for the Manitoba Moose for a little bit. I don't think so. I mean, Roberto Luongo had another good game yesterday. The Canucks beat the Hawks in a shootout.
Third straight start for the Canucks.
Third straight start. I think if you're Mike Gillis, Richie, you're still considering a move if the package coming back is right.
You're trading Luongo. You don't care about Lack. You'll find a backup goalie. And the truth is, you know, if you can get something for Luongo, get him off the books for the long haul, and you're future success is tied to Schneider. So if he goes out, then so
Let me ask you this question. You just mentioned that. Who's going to get you more value in a return, Luongo or Schneider?
Well,
why is it Luongo that they've been targeting for the trade as opposed to Schneider?
Because they want to get rid of that contract.
And nobody's going to take it.
I made the point last year, yeah. I mean, you're going to obviously get more for Schneider. Now they've signed Schneider, but still that security probably gives you a good market for him. But they want to get rid of the contract, Drew.
Well, yeah, but nobody's going to give you any assets and take on that contract. That seems to be pretty clear at this point in time.
You'd hope so. You never know what the GM's in this league.
Fine, you're right. They have done some stupid things and will do some stupid things in the future. But if you're Mike Gillis and you're trying to get the most for a player, isn't it Schneider that you got on the market?
Yeah, fair point. But, you know, if you look at it in terms of, okay, they get rid of Luongo, what do they get back? Or more specifically, what do they use? What do they put in that place with the money?
Fine.
So there's issues there. And obviously the long-term flexibility of the team, and who knows. So there's a lot of factors that go into this. But Alain Vigneault, I don't know if he's made it harder or easier. I mean, I don't think Mike Gillis, in my opinion of Mike Gillis, I don't think he's affected by the fact that Luongo's played well. Like, I don't think that'll make him hesitate in trading him. I guess he probably has a little bit of concern whether or not Schneider's affected by this, but I don't think that affects him too much either. So I still think Luongo gets dealt, and this is probably only helping his value.
Right, and it's a really... this situation seems to get more complicated. Is he going to get traded now? He's playing well. Are they going to stay with two goalies, mm-hmm. or are they showcasing him, you know, to make a trade now? Or are they going to wait till the trade deadline? Or maybe they'll wait till the offseason. Maybe they'll wait till the draft in New Jersey. But you know, a team like the Toronto Maple Leafs, who have been rumored to where he was going, apparently there was a deal in place. You know, why not go after Roberto Luongo, even if he has 8 or 9 years left on his deal? Ben Scrivens and James Reimer haven't been getting the job done. One of the problems that you've had over the last 4 or 5 years is you haven't had steady goaltending. Why aren't you offering, you know, a package of players? Well, I guess what they've said, Richie, is that, you know, the Canucks want Matt Fratton or they want Tyler Bozak, and the Leafs aren't willing to give up those young players. But I mean, you can't go any farther after this year at the very most with having those two goalies. I mean, what people have been saying is, well, you know, it's good to have two goalies. Well, you're not going to keep Roberto Luongo and Corey Schneider there together for the next 7 or 8 years. You're just not.
You might have to for the rest of this year, though.
Yeah, you might have to for this year, but after this year, I mean, you can't do it. It's too much of a distraction.
Do they consider buying out Luongo if they don't trade him after this year?
No.
Still no?
It's too valuable. You're not going to buy him out.
Well, if their goal is to get rid of his contract, that's a way to do it.
It's a lot of money for Aquilini to take on.
Okay. One last topic here today on News and Notes. Ryan Callahan is out for 10 to 14 days after hurting his shoulder. He's got a subluxation of his left shoulder. Impact on the New York Rangers and losing Callahan for 2 weeks?
Important. I think it actually may help them in the sense that they're going to split up that big line, and Tortorella might start moving the guys around a bit, Nash, Gabrick, Richards. Maybe it allows the other guys to find some chemistry and settle in, because we know Callahan will settle in when he comes back. So looking at the bright side, you say, let them develop some chemistry. They have too much talent to really not put it all together, in my opinion. And he'll come back, and he'll be a valuable asset, as he always is.
Yeah. I mean, he's the heart and soul, the captain of the team. And it's good that he's only out for a couple of weeks. The Rangers have got off to a little bit of a slow start. We were kind of expecting them to come out of the gates and win 5 games in a row or whatever. But, you know, he's out for a little while. There should be guys to step in. And, you know, Chris Kreider is a guy that I expected a little bit more out of in his first full-time NHL season. Mm-hmm. But I think Richie's right. They've started off the season with the big line there, and I think now they're starting to break it up. And I still expect the Rangers to be a top team in the East, just like Pittsburgh. I mean, Pittsburgh's whooping the Devils tonight. But they've just got off to, you know, poor starts. But those are two of the best teams. And the thing with those teams is a guy like Callahan can you know, get injured, and they probably won't miss too much of a step because they've got so much talent there.
Let's go to break. When we come back, one final segment. It's called Rapid Fire. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. One final segment this Saturday afternoon here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Reminder, Wednesday, 6 p.m., we debut NHL midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. News from around the NHL. We will have a general manager or a front office executive from another team in the NHL. So stay tuned for that. Wednesday, 6 p.m., 2 hours, NHL midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Rapid Fire.
Rapid fire, the San Jose Sharks are getting closer to being operated by a sole owner. Earlier this week, it was announced that majority owner Hasso Plattner has purchased the shares of some of his smaller investors, thus strengthening his ownership percentage of the Sharks. In a meeting with reporters after the share purchase announcement, Plattner said, and I quote, "You cannot make money with a hockey team. You cannot make money with a hotel either, and you cannot make money with a golf club. Golf club. I have all three of them." Close quote. If you were in a position to own either a hotel, a golf club, or a hockey team, which would you choose to own?
A hockey team. Why wouldn't you want to own a hockey team?
I don't know.
It's a weird question.
I'm giving you the option. The guy owns all three.
Does he own the team only for until April when they collapse again?
No, he owns it even throughout the collapse. The collapse is just an on-ice thing. It's not an off-ice
thing. Does
he
own it to the team in the playoffs, too?
He'll own them in the playoffs.
Can I just point out how odd it is that he's buying more shares of a hockey team than saying that you can't make money with it?
It is a bit of a unique phenomenon that he's publicly admitting. He claims the team lost $15 million last year.
That's such a joke.
And he's publicly saying, you just can't make money with a hockey team.
Yeah,
do you really
course.
Believe that, or well, it's just the case of another owner?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's every team, we didn't make money. It's such a joke. Come on. They're all making cash. And they're getting the better bottom line, and their franchise value goes up, and they're making it somewhere else. You know, nobody knows. These guys are too smart to buy teams to lose money. Remo?
I looked up the owner of the Sharks. He founded a company called SAP AG. They made $2.8 billion in profit last year.
So I guess owning a hockey team for him is just kind of, why not, fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, to answer your question of a hotel, a golf course, I think both of the hotel and the golf course would be a huge problem for me because I think I would eat way too much of that country club fare.
Yeah.
So I think that I'm going to go with a hockey club. I would love to own a hockey team. And in Canada. And the thing is, if you own a hockey team in Canada, it's pretty much guaranteed to make money. But, you know, as far as Hasso Plattner, great name, by the way. Never heard of this dude. But, you know...
He's heard of you, though.
Yeah, I bet. As far as, you know, buying out the other minority investors and then saying you're not going to make money on your hockey team, I mean, that's just a little stupid. You know, say some positive things about your team.
Prior to the Winnipeg Jets returning to town, many people in this fine city used to keep track of the still active NHL players that used to play for the Winnipeg Jets 1.0.
Mm-hmm. Is Sergei Bouton still playing?
No, I don't think so. Apparently in Hartford, they do the same, keeping track of their dear departed Whalers players. With the exception of Chris Pronger, who is officially retired, there is but one Hartford Whalers player left in the NHL, and that is Colorado Avalanche goaltender J.S. Giguere, who was drafted 13th overall by the Whalers in the 1995 NHL entry draft. He played 8 games for the Whalers in 96-97. In honor of the mighty Whale, who is your all-time favorite Hartford Whalers player?
Great question. Mm-hmm. Obviously,
where do I get the great question?
It was a really great question. Fantastic question. The two guys, obviously the top guys for the Whalers who you could pick are Ronnie Francis, Kevin Dineen. I'm going to go a little bit off the board here and go back to the, you know, the early 90s. A guy that was super fast, got 40 goals a couple of times, Jeff Sanderson, number 8. He was a guy that I really liked on the Whalers. His career actually tailed off a little bit, and he kind of jumped around from the Canucks and other teams. But I'm going to go with Sanderson.
Didn't know how to pass. You know, you could go Andrew Castles, Robert Kron. You want to go Sean Burke, Glenn Wesley.
I'm taking Czarly Zalapski.
Thank you. I was hoping somebody was going to drop Zalapski.
One of the best named hockey players.
Yeah, I agree with that. Captain, too, I believe, for 1 year.
I'm trying to think who my favorite would be. That's an interesting one, Drew. I think that's a good question. I'm trying
you
to
go with Adam Burt, Alexander Gadinyuk.
Adam Burt. That is the one. Was he number 33? What was Adam Burt?
6, I think.
6? Yeah, he's
we'll
a defenseman. Yeah.
We would have checked that.
Yeah, he was definitely not 33. That's a bad guess.
With Wafflegate still fresh in the minds of hockey fans in Toronto.
And you, because you had it for breakfast.
Yeah. Thank you. Someone in Boston got into the throwing food on the ice act, heaving something edible onto the ice while Bruins player Tyler Seguin was taking a shootout attempt. He scored on the attempt, but was forced to do it again, as Rule 24.4 says, if, and I quote, while the penalty shot is being taken, a spectator throws any object onto the ice, or in the judgment of the referee, interferes with the player taking the shot or the goalkeeper defending the shot, he shall permit the shot be taken again. Close quote. Seguin scored on the do-over as well, and the Bruins won the game 2-1. The food item was variously identified as a hot dog, a sausage roll, or maybe just a hunk of bread. What food item would you choose to throw on the ice to best distract a player in the midst of a shootout attempt?
Richie, I got to jump in here first and say that, you know, we'll give the illegal curve disclaimer. We are not recommending that any fan throws anything.
No, we do
on
not
the ice.
Condone that sort of activity.
We're not condoning that.
Yeah. If you have food to give away, contact Ezzy. He will come to your seat and he will pick the food up from you.
I never understood why people throw food on the ice, and people who plan on doing that, why do they bring that? It's like, I always found that weird, man.
If Ezzy was taking the shootout attempt, he would have eaten the food and then gone in and tried to score.
Okay, Richie, you know, I want to say here, I want to answer this question honestly because it's a very serious question. I'm going to say, if I were to throw anything to distract a player, I'm going to throw a hot pocket on the ice.
Do we need an explanation? I don't even want to know.
I was going to see where he's coming from. I was going to say a burrito because then it's like a bomb. It explodes.
Yeah, it's hot.
And it'll explode, too.
What about one of those jet dogs with the pierogies on it and the fried onions?
I'd
Drew, you ate one of those during the second last
but those
game.
Cost $15, so nobody's going to be throwing those on the ice.
True, they are expensive. Final question for Rapid Fire. On Monday, February the 4th, so this coming Monday, the Las Vegas Wranglers of the ECHL will host the Colorado Eagles in a game where in order to gain admittance to the game, you must be over the age of 18. To commemorate the game, the Wranglers will be wearing specially designed jerseys that will make them seem to be playing the game while topless. The specialty jerseys will, and I quote, featuring a bare chest and sculpted abs, have a Wrangler's crest tattooed over the right pectoral. Adorning the shoulders are a topless hockey quotation and the Wrangler's word mark with light arm hair filling out the details. Pretend you are a member of the Colorado Eagles. Offhand, they do have a relationship with the Winnipeg Jets, the Colorado Eagles do. Mm-hmm. Pretend you are a member of the Colorado Eagles and give me your best jersey-related trash talk that you would unleash upon your quote-unquote topless opponents.
I mean, I don't even know how we let you do the show plans anymore. How is that allowed?
Topless?
Like, what kind of question is that?
Well, I don't know how to. I'll try in a second to answer that question, Drew. But the marketing person for the Las Vegas ECHL team should be immediately fired after coming up with this ridiculous idea. I don't know why he thought that would be a good idea. If he thinks that's going to bring fans into the stands, okay, I guess. But this idea is pretty ridiculous. I mean, I guess I'd take a little hint from that commercial and maybe make fun of the guy's chest region and say that it's cold out here or something like that, or maybe his chest hair or something like that. I don't know, but this seems pretty ridiculous.
I know what I'm more worried about: the fact that Drew sat down to write that question, or that you actually answered it seriously.
Well, I have to answer it. I mean, I have to give somewhat of an answer. Cheers. We didn't even get your answer, Richie.
Cheers and jeers, please.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stick like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Richard Pollock, aside from jeering my show plan, what would you like to cheer or jeer?
That rapid fire. Oh. That was awful. Dear God.
It's getting worse and worse every week,
Richard. I'm taking the last segment off of next week's show. We already obviously give a cheer to my Babo's turning 91 today. I want to wish her happy birthday. But I want to give a cheer actually to Bill Simmons. He wrote a really great article on Grantland.com about the issue of PEDs in sports. And he talks about all sports, not just football, not basketball, and how there should be uniform testing across the board. It should be open season for these conversations because of how often it is. And I bet if we took a consensus in this room, we'd guess that there's at least one player in the NHL who is using some form of performance-enhancing drugs. And I'm fully in support of that article, and Rima should link it out.
We'd be naive if we didn't believe that.
And, before I get to my cheer, I'd just like to say I hope they never ban performance-enhancing snacks, because that's how I get through this show. So I'm going to give my cheer this week to another writer, actually. Randy Turner had a great five-page article in the Winnipeg Free Press today about amateur hockey, the cost of it and everything like that, spring elite programs. So Randy Turner, former guest of the show, he gets my cheer this week.
And I'm going to also wrap up with a cheer. I'm going to cheer the Winnipeg Jets. And now normally this is Ezzy's area to cheer the Jets. I'm going to cheer the Jets because on Monday they're coming out with a new mental health initiative that they're set to debut. It's going to help people of all ages with mental health and that sort of area. And good on the Jets for taking on the stigma and the issue of mental health in society and trying to be a leader in that area. So kudos to the Jets on that. And you'll hear more about that initiative coming up on Monday when they hold their press conference regarding that. That's it for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show for this Saturday afternoon. A big thank you to our guests, Sean Fitzgerald from the National Post, Jesse Rogers from ESPNChicago.com, and Chuck Gormley from CSNWashington.com. A big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, David Carr of Monopoly Realty, the Linden Market Dental Center, and Carbone Coal Fired Pizza. Reminder, Wednesday, 6 p.m., the debut of NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290, 2 hours of hockey talk in the middle of your week. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And the website with your latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com. For producer Tim and producer Remus, for Richard Pollock, and for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Join us again for serious hockey talk, Saturdays from noon to 3. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, only on TSN 1290. Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets.